Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. Our program today is How Frugal Innovation is Reviving the U.S. Economy. Our program today was put together and moderated by Navi Raju, who is the co-author of Jugaad Innovation. You'll be hearing more about Jugaad Innovation today. Our panelists are Beth Comstock, who is the chief marketing officer of General Electric, Hallie Tecco, co-founder and CEO of Rock Health, Jennifer Tescher, President and CEO of the Center for Financial Services, and Mark Hatch, CEO of TechShop. Now I'm going to introduce our moderator, Navi, and then he'll introduce our panel. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for that very warm intro. Good afternoon, everyone. I know it's Friday, so thank you so much for taking time to come here. I'm delighted to actually moderate this panel entitled How Frugal Innovation is Reviving U.S. Economy. And you might be wondering, what is this concept called frugal innovation? It's actually a radically new business paradigm. I would even say it's a radically new social paradigm as well. Interestingly, it's not a concept that was coined by an academic or an expensive consultant like myself, but by rather a well-respected CEO. Carlos Ghosn, the CEO of the car maker Renault-Nissan, in 2006 coined the term frugal engineering after witnessing in countries like India, China, and Brazil the unique ability of entrepreneurs in those regions to come up with very affordable, very sustainable solutions using limited resources. Some examples of these frugal solutions you may be familiar with. One is the $2,000 car called the Nano, which is produced by the Indian car maker Tata Group. There's also this interesting product you might have seen before, maybe here in the Commonwealth Club. It's called the Embrace. It's a portable infant warmer. It keeps the babies warm, premature babies, in places like India, China, by using no electricity, and it costs only $200. Compare that with the $20,000, which is the cost of an incubator in the U.S. So in a way, this product really embodies the ingenuity of frugal innovators in emerging markets, who in a way represent the spirit of MacGyver. I don't know many of you know him, but because sometime when I go to MIT, Harvard, ask them who is MacGyver, they're like, who is this guy, you know? So he's a famous, you know, TV action hero in the 80s and 90s who can basically address adversity in a very clever way and pull himself from any difficult situation using very limited resources. So in a way, in my book, Jugaad Innovation, I profile many such MacGyvers in emerging markets. But here's the exciting part. You don't have to go to Africa, India, or China to see frugal innovation action. It's actually a concept that is taking roots right here in the United States. And I'm delighted to have on the panel here today the American pioneers of frugal innovation who are really creating affordable and sustainable solutions in industries ranging from healthcare to financial services to manufacturing. We all know why so desperately in this country we need frugal solutions, because just to give you some numbers, right, 50 million Americans today lack health insurance. We all know that the middle class in this country is rapidly losing its purchasing power. And then more importantly, natural resources like water and oil are getting scarce as well. So in the next 50 minutes or so, we will be learning from these pioneers of frugal innovation how they go about creating these affordable and sustainable products and services that deliver greater value to U.S. citizens while promoting greater inclusivity in our society as well. I want to begin with Beth Comstock, CMO of GE, and I'm very happy that she managed to come because she's a global, you know, citizen, and she just finished attending the TED conference, and she just leaves sharp at 1 o'clock, so we are delighted to have her here. So, Beth, I want to begin with you because, you know, you represent large companies. I mean, think about the notion of frugal innovation. People don't associate the word frugality, let alone agility, with large companies, and yet you seem to be driving this kind of movement within GE. Can you comment on why this is relevant now for GE and how you go about addressing this imperative?
Yeah, Navi, a couple of key themes. I think if anyone has known someone who worked at GE, or if you've ever worked at GE, you would think of us as frugal. We're tight with a buck. So frugal has never been an issue, and after 130 years of being alive, you do learn a thing or two about invention and innovation, because you can't sustain yourself for over a century without knowing when to change. So those two things are embedded in our cultural DNA. But I think a couple of things have changed and have caused us to change the way we operate. Probably the biggest recognition, two big recognitions. One is a humble recognition from a big company that we don't have all the answers, that we can't do everything ourselves, that we need to partner to share ideas, to share risk, to move faster, that that the problems we're out to solve in a company like ours related to energy, healthcare, transportation, financial services, you can't solve those alone, even if you are a big company. So that need to partner, to invite other people in, has been a growing imperative for us, certainly over the past decade. The second thing that has totally, I think, forced us into a more of a urgency is just the global marketplace and the speed of which the world is moving. Really a multi-speed world where you've got certain parts of the world moving fast, certain parts moving even faster, some not moving at all. But I think for us in the past decade, it was this sense of going to India, much like what happened at Nissan, going to India, going to China, now in Africa, and you show up with your high-end, world's best technology, and you go, great, and you feel really good. Look, I'm a marketing person. I do market development work, and we have great technology, but it doesn't solve every need on its own. And so what we've tried to do is put our market and technical resources together to focus, what does that market need? And when you show up in a hospital in India, what a Tier 3 hospital needs is much different than what UCSF needs. It might need this in Delhi, but it doesn't need it in a very small city in India where you don't even have continual power. So we show up with something that might work at UCSF. It doesn't work in a city where there's not any regular power. Not to mention that the hospital probably can't afford all the bells and whistles that come in a well-organized incubator. So it was basically forcing ourselves to live in the markets where our customers are. And by live, I mean we felt we had to take engineers, marketers, designers, put them in hospitals, put them in railroads, and figure out on the fly, I mean, you call it Jugaad innovation, what can you do to pull pieces together? So I would say it's those two themes that have come together for us in a big way.
And do you see in a way that even though these are things you learn in emerging markets, there's a relevance for right here in the United States as well?
And that is exactly what's happening. I mean, I think a couple of things have accelerated. It's certainly the economic downturn that we saw a couple of years ago. Austerity measurements around the globe have forced people to say, it's not just I have to do more with less, but this sense of just it's smarter. There's an elegance about what can I do to put the best possible technology at the lowest cost, just what's needed. I really think to us, frugal innovation has been just what's needed. And the interesting thing, I mentioned India. I mean, we worked very hard on a baby warmer that was designed in India. And you might think, well, that's great. It'll serve Tier 3 hospitals in India and China and Africa. The biggest market outside of India is Finland. So it just goes to show you that that there are different segments of the market of markets around the globe for well-organized, simple, agile products.
So it's a really universal kind of thinking, and applications can be anywhere in the world.
Well, as a marketer, I tend to look at the world by needs-based segmentation.
Yeah.
So if you look at the world by needs, it's much different
than
a developed or a developing, a high end or a low end, and I think that's one of the big ahas out of the past decade for us.
Great, thank you so much, Beth. Jennifer, you actually represent another, if I may say so, a dinosaur sector, the financial service sector, known for being very bloated and million-dollar bonuses and whatnot. And yet you are trying to bring in this frugal mindset and inclusive mindset in that industry. What's going on? What's the imperative for doing that?
Yeah, well, I'm not a banker. I just play one on TV, I promise. Just like Beth said, tremendous technological change is going on in all of our lives, in what we as people and consumers expect of our service providers. That's certainly true in financial services. If you layer that on top of a financial crisis, a global mortgage meltdown, trust scores for financial services that are, you know, barely above Congress, which isn't saying very much. It's an incredibly challenging time in the financial services industry. Yet, with the hollowing out of the middle class and all the other financial challenges we have, it's a time where we as people actually need resources in the, you know, we need financial services providers to provide us guidance, to provide us tools to better manage our money and to help us achieve some resilience and ultimately some prosperity. So despite all of the challenges, it's an incredibly exciting time in the financial services arena because all of those elements are making this a highly disruptive moment. All kinds of new providers in the marketplace. It's wonderful we're having this conversation in San Francisco because some of the biggest disruptors of financial services sit here in the Valley, and they're not necessarily all financial services companies. They may be companies that are seen as technology companies or media companies or telecommunications companies, but are disrupting the way in which we think about financial services, which is ultimately really good for consumers because, again, like what Beth said, the just what's needed. I think the element of the Jugaad innovation that I think is really relevant here is around simplicity. It's not just that big companies or financial services companies are bloated and slow. It's that they're complex. Complexity is killing all of us, and it's particularly true in financial services. And so I think the opportunity that both technology and sort of a Jugaad spirit offers is for innovators to cut through all of that, start with a completely clean piece of paper as opposed to band-aiding old technologies and say, I'm going to create something that's incredibly simple, that puts the customer at the center. What is your real need? I'm going to solve for that. I'm not going to solve for, well, I have this mousetrap that does the following things. How can I plug you into it? But what mousetrap can I build that ultimately puts you first?
And there's one statistic, Jennifer, that maybe the audience may not be aware of, if you want to share that. I mean, how important is this problem of financial exclusion in this country?
Right. So financial exclusion is a big issue globally. I think it's hard for us to sometimes see the issue in front of us here in the United States because if we walk out the street here, there's going to be a bank on every corner. And so when you see a bank on every corner, I think we sometimes forget that there's lots of people who are not well served by the current system. But in some ways, the bigger issue is not people who are completely outside the system. The bigger issue is people who are in the system and are poorly served by it. And that is a growing number of Americans we've had to tighten our purse strings, our wallets, as we might have experienced a job loss or a foreclosure, and as those institutions are also finding themselves having to tighten their own belts and rethink their own business models. Mm-hmm. And so we don't often talk about this as sort of financial exclusion because at the end of the day, it's about serving all customers well.
Good point, yeah. And I think the numbers I heard is like 60 million people or something in this country are either unbanked or underbanked, right?
That's exactly right.
Which is a massive number. So, of course, another statistics we are more familiar is the fact that 50 million Americans lack health insurance. So I want to turn to Hallie Teko, who actually runs Rock Health, which is interestingly based in Chinatown right here in San Francisco. So, Hallie, tell us more about how you go about making healthcare more affordable and accessible to Americans.
Sure. Well, everything Jennifer just said, just exchange healthcare for financial services the whole time. I was like, this is my world. In terms of really focusing on affordability and access, I think healthcare is like financial services, it's universal. We do have to figure out a solution to provide care to everyone. This is our responsibility as a society. And so what entrepreneurs are stepping up and doing is thinking about innovative solutions using technology and game design and big data, all these really great things that have shifted other industries and bringing it to healthcare to think about how they can make tools that either bring down the cost of care or improve the quality of care. And access, obviously, ensuring that everybody has access to care is part of that. So I brought today two examples of startups that we've incubated. We've incubated 49 startups over the past couple years. The one that I just put over my phone is a prototype of something called CellScope. And what they've done is built a otoscope. It costs just a few dollars to build, and it sits over a smartphone and turns it into an otoscope for parents to detect ear infections at home. So as you can imagine, a parent with, I guess you can't probably see it, but a parent with a child with chronic ear infections wouldn't have to go into the doctor's office every single time and pay the high cost and the opportunity cost of actually going to the doctor each time and instead take the image at home, send it to the doctor, and for a lower cost be able to diagnose if it's an ear infection or not. So on the consumer side, we're seeing a lot of really inventive consumer-driven tools. And then obviously the providers and the healthcare system needs innovative tools as well. This is an example of a team that just graduated last week from Rock Health, and they're digitizing the life science supply chain. So this is a syringe, and I lost the needle around here somewhere. So
so be careful. Be careful when you walk around.
But what they're doing is digitizing this and putting this little RFID tag on all of the items in a hospital, starting with the pharmacy and the pharmacy kits, so that the hospital can more easily identify items that are expired, items that are missing, et cetera, which brings down the cost tremendously for the hospitals.
Interesting. And also, the cost of these products are, I guess, a fraction of what is available right now as substitute solutions. Is that correct?
Sure. I mean, right now you have kind of an analog solution. So you have to physically take your child to a doctor's office and pay the costs. And there are great costs of having a physical office and having all of the staff that works within a hospital or doctor's office there. So bringing down the cost by just digitizing the image, sending it to the doctor. The doctor needs just a few minutes to identify if it's an ear infection or not.
And what is fascinating with the example of this CellScope is that you also help save what is most precious resource in the Western context, which is time. Mm-hmm. And often we talk about frugality. We always talk about saving money, but saving time is equally very, very important in the Western context. So I think there's something to mention. Mark, sorry for keeping you waiting, because the reason we wanted to have you last kind of in this first, you know, question series is because you, in a way, are enabling a lot of the solutions that these people are talking about. So can you describe more about, you know, what is TechShop and how you go about enabling
sure.
creation of frugal solutions?
So for those who don't know, TechShop is a membership-based fabrication studio. It's 17,000 square feet of every machine tool, woodworking tool, plastic, electronics, textiles, large automobile bay, lots of sexy 3D printers, literally everything you need to make just about anything on the planet. Membership-based means it's $125 a month. You take a class on a welding machine for $80, and you now know how to weld or you can weld. As one of our members have said, we completely and utterly crush the major barrier to innovation in the hardware space, something on the order of 2 to 3 orders of magnitude. So if it used to take you $1 million to launch a hardware product, you can now do it for 10 grand. If it took you 100,000, you can do it for 2 or 3,000. And as a result, you can take more risks. And as a result, you can engage more innovators. There are $470 billion controlled by the creative class in the U.S., and it's disposable income. I love that word. We're spending it on, you know, Frappuccinos and McMansions and SUVs. And if we can take that disposable income and convert that into innovation investments, we can change the world. And in fact, some of our members already have. The Embrace blanket that came out of the D School was originally actually done at TechShop in Menlo Park and is on track to save 100,000 babies' lives in the next 5 years. Famously, Square, the peer-to-peer transaction processing play that's just down the street. That's one's interesting. It's Jack Dorsey and James McKelvey. What was most interesting to me is that they came up with the idea, they hit Silicon Valley, and they got turned down. Then James came in and built the prototype, went back out and raised $10 million in their Series A. They're now famously worth $3.2 billion. We'll do about $20 billion transactions next year. And we'll have something on the order of 1,000 employees. It only cost them a few $1,000s to get the prototype, but without the prototype, they couldn't get the best minds in Silicon Valley to fund them. That's what the power of access to cheap, frugal tools does for a MacGyver.
Fantastic. So essentially, this is the digital MacGyvers.
Indeed.
You can call them that way. So, Bet, I want to kind of come back to you because you heard some interesting examples of people like TechShop driving frugal innovation, Rock Health incubating digital startups, and then Jennifer talked about frugal innovation taking hold in financial service sector as well. So sitting in a GE, essentially, you have two options. One is you can try to do it all yourself, but you talk about the spirit of, you know, openness and inclusion. How open are you, in fact, in the sense that, you know, often this concept of open innovation has been very popular in the last 10 years, but how do you actually practice it? Do you have partnerships with the likes of TechShop or Rock Health, for example?
We do, which works out quite well. We've partnered with all together here, so it works out quite well. I think openness is always more of an aspiration than the reality. So we're feeling very good about how open we've become, but we're not nearly as open as we need to be. So I'll caveat that. The kind of openness we've done of late, we've had a number of challenges. Our most successful was in the clean tech energy space, where we had the Eco-Imagination Challenge and got something like 5,000 business plans, and were able to not only fund but help encourage and stimulate. So that's been one track. We've worked quite a bit with Hallie to we want to be around disruptive thinkers. We'd like to think there are many in GE, but we know there are many who wake up every day saying, I'm going to kill GE. And so it's in our best interest to get to know them and to say, hey, maybe you can help us to, what does GE have? Why would an entrepreneur want to work with GE? We have access to technology and access to markets and customers. And so to say, hey, this is a great idea. We have a quick access to a hospital, to a whole market. That becomes a really interesting partnership. So we've had some great early learnings, and I think it's just early days working with Hallie and the team at Rock Health to learn. And then with Mark, it's, I don't know, Mark, we sort of discovered each other about a year and a half ago, just as Mark was way ahead of this, but we were getting this sense of, just like in the software community, there's been an openness, it's starting to happen in hardware. And I don't know, Mark, you had this great statistic, so if you take it to GE, what it would have cost Thomas Edison, who founded GE, to create the light bulb or prototype, you know, basically that's been disrupted. So it was the cost and the ability for an everyday innovator to go into a tech shop. Again, it's very disruptive for a company like ours. So we want to make sure we're working with people like that so that they have an outlet when they want to scale. So that's what has taken us to work with some of the folks.
So you're saying that there are many other Edisons out there. We need to go partner with them as opposed to,
Right, because if you're a budding Edison, I mean, okay, Jack Dorsey has access to a lot of funding and potential channels. Somebody, you know, Joe Dorsey, he doesn't necessarily have access to a big market and a big technical lab like we do. So that's where we're trying to say, how do we collaborate with startups? What do we have to offer at Science and Scale? And if you're a startup, you keep disrupting, you keep doing what you're doing, and hopefully there's a good partnership there.
These are the outliers, basically, that you're looking for as well, in a way.
Well, outliers, I think there's also, we can come back to it, but I think that worth discussing at some point, there's also a huge cultural imperative to what the people that Hallie is working with, what they can teach at GE. So yes, we can help them get to market. They can help fill our product gaps with sales. But I'm happy to talk at some point. The cultural imperative
Absolutely.
Is huge.
And on that note, go ahead, Jennifer.
I also think that it's not just the formal partnerships, but it's the interconnections between our work. I mean, just in the few minutes that some of us have met each other for the first time, we've discovered lots of interconnections. So you told the story of Jack Dorsey inventing Square. Well, Jack Dorsey spoke at our conference a few years ago before Square had really gotten any market traction. About half the room was sort of totally taken with it, right?
Right.
And the other half of the room, largely grizzled bankers, were saying,
What do you know?
And how is this going to meet regulations? And how is this going to meet against fraud? And look where he is today.
Well, and James, his partner, for the previous 10 years, was a glass blower.
That's right.
Right. So he walks in with, I'm a software guy and a glass blower, and we're going to disrupt the entire merchant banking system in the United States.
Well, and really, he's democratized access to the payment system. I often tell the Jack Dorsey story in the same breath that I tell the AP Giannini story, which is appropriate that we're sitting in San Francisco. But many of you may know that AP Giannini founded what went on later to become Bank of America, and he founded it just before the great earthquake around the turn of the century. Back then, banks didn't make loans to immigrants or the average Joe on the street. They were completely risk-averse. And he had this idea, having been a successful immigrant and entrepreneur, that he would make loans to the common man. So he opened his own bank in a bar, right, across the street from Columbus Bank and Trust, where he had been on the board unsuccessfully. And in the wake of the earthquake, he loaded his old produce wagon. He used to be in the produce business. He loaded his produce wagon with essentially currency and, you know, rode off to the wharf and sat there for a couple of days making handshake loans to people to help them rebuild their lives in the wake of the earthquake and the fires that ensued. No one else wanted to do that. And he really democratized single-handedly access to banking. Here comes Jack Dorsey almost 100 years later and essentially does the same thing for payments. And I think that's really at the heart of what frugal innovation is about. It's about simplicity. It's about really approaching it from the consumer's perspective. It's about not worrying about what the status quo was, but starting with what you've got.
Right. I'm sure that the bankers who attended your conference 2 years ago are eating a big humble pie, looking at the market cap of Square. Hallie, on that note, I mean, let's talk about our favorite organizations, HMOs, and large organizations. How are they responding? Because in a way, you need their involvement as well, right? Because they're facing the kind of the patient in a way. Are they interested in the kind of solutions that you're incubating? Are you working with them as well?
Yeah, so we have about a dozen partners, and I think we have them in kind of two groups. One would be the provider network. So we work closely with Kaiser Permanente, Mayo Clinic, UCSF, and Harvard Medical School, and they provide us with everything from capital to medical expertise to pilots and medical validation for the startups that are participating in the Rock Health program. And they're all just absolutely enthusiastic about working with startups and innovators. I think on an individual level, the people within those organizations all want access to better tools. So they're really excited to work and see what's kind of happening at the early stage so that they can integrate that into their everyday practice. And then hospitals as a system are being incentivized more than ever with legislation and consumer demand to ensure that they have low-cost tools, they improve their outcomes, reduce readmissions, all these really important aspects of the healthcare system, and they know that technology can solve some of these problems. Now, it's not that easy. It's really challenging to set up a pilot and a trial and sell into a hospital, but having the intention from the providers and the enthusiasm for them has been really wonderful for us and for the startups that we incubate.
So are they looking at it primarily by saying, hey, we can work with Rock Health and save a buck or two, or is there something deeper than that?
So I think
Beth was talking about the cultural aspect.
So we really serve as a filter for them. They don't have a venture arm set up at most of these hospitals to help filter and do the due diligence on the startups coming in. They don't have a process in which to work with startups and early stage companies that may or may not be around in 2-5 years. So they really look to us as kind of vetting the best of the best, and they know that we work with the best in every segment. We work with the best investors, we work with the best corporates and the best medical partners, so they can de-risk their process in working with startups.
Fascinating. On that note, actually, Mark, I mean, often when you talk about the MacGyvers, you think about these, you know, independent entrepreneurs
right.
with crazy ideas.
Yeah.
But what about large companies? I mean, do they have any interest, like companies, I mean, like corporations
oh, sure.
or large organizations?
Yeah, I mean, we're working with General Electric on a couple of different programs. They invited us to join the Get Skills to Work network, actually as part of a DARPA VA effort to open locations on the East Coast. And we actually are opening our very first East Coast location. Well, that's Pittsburgh. It's not quite East Coast. From here it is, I guess.
Can you elaborate, Mark, on what that is?
Yeah, it actually opens tomorrow. So DARPA, we're working with them on an advanced manufacturing play and doing some work for them. But then they've also roped in the Veterans Administration. We will be delivering 1,000 memberships a year for the next 2 years to veterans who are interested in innovating. And that'll be across the entire platform, so there will be some that are here. So, you know, the VA understands that not all returning vets want to go work for somebody else. Some want to start their own businesses, so we'll be working there. Ford is another example. They funded a location with us in Dearborn, close to their headquarters. And they had a couple of things that they wanted to do, but I think the most telling thing that's happened is that it's using our platform as a way of creating internal MacGyvers, if you will. They've increased the number of quality internal patent submissions by 30% in 1 year. You know, this is a major metric that any large company does to track what kind of innovation is coming in. It's how many ideas that are patentable are coming into the company. So we've got Ford, we've got GE, we've got DARPA. So yes, large companies are starting to see that there are lots of ways to leverage this.
And, you know, now, just a fun story to build on. Mark and I created a mini tech shop on the road that we call GE Garages, where we were able to take a very small version of tech shop and show people. And there was this great story. We were in Austin together last year, and there was this young girl, 15. You could tell her dad made her go, like, oh, I can't believe I have to go to this thing, Dad. And she came back 4 days in a row and said, I never knew I could work with my hands. I never knew I could have this kind of skill. And she claims that, you know, she's going down a whole different educational path because of this. So the power of allowing people to create and make, and for a company like ours, You know, to think that woman might one day want to come and work at GE in design, in manufacturing, that's very powerful.
Yeah,
I also think, you know, one of the things we've been talking about on this panel is how do you change the culture of large companies? Do you do it from the outside in or the inside out? And I actually think we've both talked about, both of those possibilities, that when you embed folks in MacGyver style inside of a large institution, that can help to change the culture from the inside out. And other times, particularly in the financial services arena, having disruptive innovators competitively, you know, from the outside, sort of pounding the walls, sort of can help from the outside in. And I think we need both of those.
So the idea is that you have to disrupt yourself before somebody else does it to you, right?
Exactly.
Absolutely. Beth has a hard stop at 1 o'clock, so I'm very conscious of that. One of the questions, Beth, I want to ask you about is the whole role of legislation and regulation, right? And I always hear from large companies like they're over-regulated in this country, and regulation is a bad thing. But it seems like you have a slightly different opinion on that, whether it's regulation on, you know, environmental aspects or otherwise. How do you see the role of regulation in a way either inhibiting or potentially helping innovation?
Well, we're in highly regulated industries. I mean, you want the aviation business to be regulated. You want healthcare to... There are good reasons these industries are regulated. And what we found, especially in the clean energy goals, governments that set very high standards set a really high bar for technical innovation. So generally, we embrace standards and goals as a way to go forward. And I could point to many, many seeds that were planted, a hybrid locomotive that was created to go after emissions in transportation that then for us gave root to a whole new energy storage business that we incubated in 5 years that wouldn't have happened if you, trickle back. I think what often happens, however, is regulation becomes bureaucratic. It becomes slow, it stifles innovation. And frankly, if you speak to the cultural piece, one of our biggest challenges is, okay, regulation's regulation, you deal with it. What often happens in a company is it becomes an alibi. Mm. And that's the hardest thing, where you get the internal people who they use regulation as a reason to say no, as opposed to regulation to say, here's the box we're in, now how do we innovate? We know what the guidelines are, it's the guardrails. And oftentimes, if you're not careful, your culture gets a bit stagnant because it's like, no, we can't do that, or they think the lawyers are in charge of the innovation machine. And actually, some of the most innovative people I've worked with are lawyers that try to figure out, we know what we can't do. Let's help you figure out what you can do. So I think you got to think about it as an enabler, not as an alibi.
So basically, regulation becomes a set of constraints, and then the moment they become constraints, you can turn that into, a challenge.
It doesn't always feel that way.
I'll take an opposing view on that, just relative to the startup, and particularly on hardware. So Chris Anderson has recently come out with the book, Makers, the Next Industrial Revolution. He recently, just last week, stated, and this is Chris Anderson, the guy who was at the head of Wired magazine. If there's anybody that knows something about the Internet, I would say it would be Chris and Wired. And he said, and I quote, if you thought the web was big, I believe this is going to be bigger. So the next industrial revolution is going to be bigger than the Internet. And we have managed in the United States in the last 20 years to completely destroy the IPO market for companies under 50 million. A 93% reduction in IPOs under 50 million. Hmm. Right at the inflection point in industry history, where you got innovation coming, and we can revolutionize the globe. Mm-hmm. If we don't get that fixed in the U.S., it will move to Europe or India or China or where it can get done. Mm-hmm.
On that point, I mean, talk about Europe. I was in Europe 2 weeks ago, and I won't name which countries, but I actually was interested to know that they are actually looking at tech shop in a way to kind of spur innovation. So, yes, there could be regulations like a stifling, but it seems like some regulators are looking at you and thinking you can help them, actually.
There are countries with a little more top-down approach to innovation than the U.S. So we're making some great progress, as it turns out, in Germany, France, and the Netherlands right now. I've hired one managing director there, and he's tearing it up. So it's possible that we'll end up with more tech shops in Europe in the next 5 years than we do here.
Which could be actually at the expense of U.S. potentially. So, Hallie, actually I want to ask you as well, because healthcare is another sector which is highly regulated, and I deal a lot with large medical companies and healthcare organizations. They also always talk about regulation as being like, this reason why, as Beth says, an alibi to not innovate. What has been your experience in the healthcare sector?
I think that universally entrepreneurs understand that healthcare needs to be regulated. We want to ensure safety, and they want to work within, have someone else create a framework with which they can work and follow some set of guidelines. The problem that we hear most often with the entrepreneurs that we're working with who are creating software and hardware products is that it's how they're ambiguous, the rules around, especially mobile health, is that this is a new domain, and if you put an app on an iPhone, and that does that turn the iPhone into a medical device? Does it mean that it's regulated like a medical device? And so there are these questions that haven't been answered. The FDA put out kind of draft guidelines last year, which actually confused people a little bit more. And so that's the part that we hope gets sorted quickly is entrepreneurs are smart and they're agile and they can follow rules. And if they can do it also cheaply and quickly, that's great. But if the rules aren't clear, then there's problems and people don't want to risk their time and efforts working on something that might get shut down.
Mm. So, Navi, I would offer, I think we see it from the healthcare industry too, such an imperative. Health costs are not sustainable in any country, but certainly not this country. Entrepreneurism could just create speed rails, could get us things faster. You talked about things we're inventing in India that we could bring to the U.S. That's one path, but just turn what we've got loose here. Every day we see disruptive entrepreneurs who can do things a lot cheaper, but unfortunately in many cases they go to other countries to develop because some of the regulation gets in their way. So this could be a frugal effort that certainly our country could take on.
Right. Absolutely.
I do think, though, that this regulation question rubs both ways, because on the one hand, bright lines are really helpful to then let folks just run. But bright lines also can be constraining, particularly when we're talking about the edge, the bleeding edge of innovation, where we don't even know what the rules should be yet because there hasn't been any room yet for experimentation. And so I think an approach that is happening in financial services holds some promise. You know, we have this new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, highly controversial, a new financial regulator aimed at focusing on the needs of consumers. And they are trying to recognize the fact that they have a dual mission. Their mission is to protect consumers and to promote access. And in order to focus on promoting access, they've launched something called Project Catalyst, where we've been advising them. And it's how can we promote innovation to encourage access, but do it in a controlled way so that we give space to the experimentation. Maybe before rules even exist, we create some temporary boundaries for trial. And then once we have some experimentation underway, then it'll put us in a position where we can write better rules. Mm. It reminds me a little bit of how the FDA, gives space to drug companies to try things out and then come to us and we will approve or not approve. And so I think that thinking about Jiu-Guide innovation, not just as a framework for companies or entrepreneurs, but for government and for regulatory bodies, to what Beth was saying, I think is really important.
So what I'm hearing from you is that rather than having this very adversarial relationship between regulators and entrepreneurs or innovators, you are promoting some kind of a cooperative spirit in a way, which will be a win-win ultimately
for
everyone.
You could sequester some entrepreneurs. That might be the kind of sequester we need to be thinking about.
Exactly. On that note, I want to make sure we open up the floor to questions from the audience as well. There are mics out there, so if you want to queue up, queue in, and feel some questions, would be very helpful. And one request, please state your name and please keep your questions as short as you can. Thank you so much.
And I would like to just remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. Our program today is How Frugal Innovation is Reviving the U.S. Economy, led by moderator Navi Raju. Our other panelists are Beth Comstock, Hallie Tecco, Jennifer Tesher, and Mark Hatch. We're now going to turn it over for questions from the audience, and please keep your questions short, but do speak into the microphone. Thank you.
Go ahead, sir.
There's an innovation in finance called crowdfunding. How can crowdfunding support some of the technology innovations that you're so fond of?
Well, it already has, but I'll take the SEC comment first. So the worst thing we can do is announce that we're going to announce the rules so that at least we have an idea, and then not do it in June, not do it in August, and then maybe delay it until the end of the year.
Yes.
I know a lot of innovators that were counting on those rules, however onerous they may have been.
That's right.
I don't care how onerous they are. Just get them done. So there's my plug on the SEC. So this is a small device. It's just an iPhone holder that one of the our inventors created. And what was nice about it was, you know, he's 19-year-old, decided he wasn't going to go to MIT, even though he had gotten in, because he wanted to start companies. I don't recommend that to my children or others, but that was his personal passion. And so he used Kickstarter to create just a little iPhone aluminum holder. And he raised $100,000 on that and built that and sold those off. And then his second project was a beautiful iPad keyboard, and he raised $780,000. You know, that goes well beyond the frugal innovation threshold. You know, that's not bad for a 20-year-old kid to hook up with a bunch of folks and create an absolutely gorgeous iPad accessory. Is actually, it's very encouraging. And we've had probably $5 million worth of Kickstarter and Indiegogo projects get launched.
Is that the one you have there, or is it...
No, this one's different. So this was, so I've got an iPad case here. It's made out of bamboo and book binding. Patrick Buckley, a local entrepreneur. What's great about Patrick is he would describe himself as a failed entrepreneur because he had tried like 8 other ideas in the previous 2 years. But we like to say that we can turn you into a MacGyver. We can run you through your own industrial revolution in 60 to 90 days. Now, Patrick was an overachiever. Not only did he go through his own industrial revolution in 90 days, he had $1 million in sales at the end of 90 days. He did $3 million in the first year, $10 million in the second. He's got 50 employees over in Dogpatch. You know, so the ability, he was going to do a Kickstarter campaign, but he was getting so much success so quickly, he just cash floated himself.
You know, I think from a company's perspective, I think Kickstarter does a couple of great things. One is it's a you know, focus group. It's a market development person's dream. You can start to see if an idea is going to work or not. I was in at a conference recently where we had some folks from Kickstarters and some more established CEOs of companies, and they started to think through, how do I use this for much more rapid prototyping and iteration? So how does it change my culture, my dynamics, and then how do I find talent early? I might want to go hire that guy, not that he may want to come and work for GE, but that this is a sense that you can find ideas and find products faster than you're ever going to do yourself. Those two things are starting to awaken in the levels of companies in, I think, a very healthy way.
Very good point. I think there's another question we'll field from this side. Go ahead, sir.
Aluwalia, physician from Chicago. I feel privileged to attend this meeting here, and I listen to you people in Chicago. I listen to you people on Thursday evening. My question is that it has been mentioned about frugality, about technology, research, progress. In the area of medical work, I'd be delighted to see, not me, but somebody younger than I, since food is not being served, I can talk about this topic. Find me a non-surgical cure for hemorrhoids. There may be some people who have suffered from it. And besides North America, Western Europe, the rest of the world is very well aware of how to achieve that. And if we get to that, for that we need to put a bomb under, there are 90-plus med schools in this country, under the faculty in the Department of Preventive Medicine, Social Medicine, and Community Medicine. If we can wake those people up, in less than 5 years, we'll have it.
Thank you so much. And I think, Hallie, this might be a point for you to talk about as well, because you also interface some time with these, you know, universities as well, right? Because there's also a need for changing the mindset of the physicians as well. And one other thing you may want to talk about, I suspect, is that the people who run these companies that incubate are not all technologists. Some of them are physicians as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, we focus on the commercialization. So generally, someone would come up with their prototype at tech shop or at a university and then come to us. We really focus on market development and business planning versus the actual technology.
Okay, great. Next question, please.
Yes, this is a 6-year-old cell phone, and it's such an antique, it's probably ready for the Smithsonian. The reason I use this is I have a slight intention tremor and cannot use the touch tone type of smartphones that I use, or use those small keys. And I would certainly like somebody have a keyboard like this that I could use with my little tremor, don't have a problem, and still have the apps that a iPhone, et cetera, has. The other situation is technology gets more sophisticated, more things can go wrong. And I've had three microwave ovens that, after about a year or so, they just don't work.
Right, right.
And so maybe there's a time to sort of reverse engineer some of these products so they last longer and they're more user-friendly.
Very good point, absolutely. And I think what I'm hearing also, a lot of interesting requirements coming from the field. Maybe you should create like a bulletin board, you know, a tech shop and inspire people to, you know, solve those issues.
There's a great smartphone cover that has a keyboard that I don't remember the name of it, but you're starting to see. That you can attach it to your iPhone. And so I think you're starting to see entrepreneurs who are starting to look at needs back and saying the market, hearing you and doing it. So I'm encouraged by that.
Absolutely. And there's a platform called Incentive. I'm not sure if GE has used it, but large companies can put out contests like RFPs for problems they want to solve. I feel like we need that for consumers. So you can say, I want a better phone and see what people propose.
Good point. And I think just briefly, thank you, sir. And briefly also, I think in the financial service sector, I think mobile banking is going to be huge, isn't it? So mobile phones could play a great role, right?
Yeah, in fact, I was just going to say that we're actually in the process now of running an app challenge to encourage folks to develop apps that help people better manage their money. I'm afraid it won't help with your immediate problem. But the very first phase, which we did in partnership with the U.S. Treasury Department, was around gathering ideas. So, you know, in 140 characters or less, tweet us, tell us what kind of apps you want created. And we got entries from all over this country from just, you know, random people. And in fact, we then ran a second challenge, which was, okay, bring us your ideas in a more fully baked form. And we had, a housewife, we had a former school teacher, we had a real estate broker, all of whom in their daily lives were seeing challenges and had ideas for how to fix them. So it's sort of the service version of the tech shop maker, in a way. And I'm pleased to say that we're now down to 13 finalists of folks who are actually building real apps that will live in the App Store, and we will pick a winner sometime this summer here in San Francisco. There is real power in tapping into the collective energy and ideas of the citizenry as we really think about how to improve our own lives.
Fascinating. Thank you.
KISS, the KISS rule. Keep it simple, stupid.
Excellent.
For people like
Very
me.
Good point.
Great
Absolutely.
Point.
Great point. Next question, please. Thank you.
In this side of the column here?
Please, go ahead.
Oh, okay, thanks. Thank you very much. Great. My question is, frugal innovation is about simplicity, and it's about refocusing on what matters the most, or actually through the filter of human needs or people and the soft factors. And you were talking about culture, and that quite often status quo, you know, you have a business plan, bottom line, and so you are quantification. Each time you come with a proposal of something, you need a quantification of hard facts, not the soft. So my question to you is, in frugal innovation, you have a lot of intangibles, so to speak. They are very much tangible. You can see it, but it's on the bleeding edge. So for the status quo, it's still quotation mark intangible. How do you quantify, and how we do overcome this quantification of the impact or the benefits from frugal innovation? Thank you.
Who wants to take it?
I'll start, and I mean, it's a good segue to Hallie. I think if you want innovation to thrive in any culture, big company or small, you have to allow time to iterate the idea and incubate it. So you have to create. You can't have an idea and expect it to have a profit and loss statement within a very short period of time. And that creates certain tension. But in a company like ours, we've created a protected class of ideas that we make sure get the right funding, don't get killed when they're quarter by quarter pressures. The pitfall sometimes, and this may be unexpected consequences, sometimes if you're not careful, you dabble. Meaning you're a big company and you can fund a lot of ideas, and so none of them really get what they need. And so you have a lot of things that maybe don't scale, aren't going to have the impact. And I think that's why we've been encouraged working with teams like Hallie's, is the ability to learn how to incubate, to take a hard-minded approach. We might just not kill something because we like the guy or woman who's running it, right? And what you learn from venture and startup is you got to make payroll. You got to feed yourself and your family. That kind of discipline is something we're trying to bring a much more tough-minded approach inside.
And that's why our partners love visiting our office. And Navi, you've been to our office. We have a space in Chinatown above a scarf shop. And it's not fancy and it's, you know, not plush. We have all IKEA furniture, but it's charming and it really gives the sense of you haven't made it yet, so you need to work really, really hard. And I think that that's a sense that you don't necessarily get at a large corporation.
A couple of things. One, not all of these are really simple, so that's also fascinating. The world's fastest electric motorcycle was built on site. The world's most efficient data cooling center was built on site. One of the first NanoSat satellites that's now flying around the world were built on site. So you can do very, very, very sophisticated things with some fairly simple tools. I'm having ongoing dialogues with CTOs at large companies, and at the moment I'm trying to convince them to set aside 5 to 10% of their research budget so that we can double the amount of innovation coming out of their labs. But part of the trick is then to democratize access to those funds. So the conversation at Ford is fascinating, and they were one of the leaders in this space. The intellectual property attorney that's driving this said, you know, most of our engineers actually don't work in research and development. Most of them are in operations. We don't let them go into research and development, and the general manager doesn't let them goof around with the operations. And you know what? We actually have thousands of engineers who work in marketing and HR and in finance and other parts. And so one of the things, the reasons we came was now I'm allowing all of these other engineers, and then I would say, and we're going to convert some people into MacGyvers, and give them access to these kinds of tools. Because for, you know, if you take an order of magnitude or two out of the cost to get to that first prototype, that is an enormous opportunity. You now can innovate 10 times, fail 10 times more often, and still match your current output.
Yeah, great. This is the Google principle, fail often, fail early, fail, you know, fast. Next question, please, and then I'll come to the...
Hi, I'm Simon from Salesforce. And as I say, the book, I think, Jigad Innovation, phenomenal read, and listening to your points on the panel has been really, really enlightening. Much of what you're saying is about effectively creating more and more innovators in our world by giving them more tools and enabling people to be able to innovate more frugally, as you said. But if you find those innovators and you give them the right problem, the problem is also not necessarily that they've got these new tools, but they think about using those tools according to the educational framework that they've been given. How do you also solve for the fact that people need to be broken out of the orthodoxical way in which they look at the world and break people away from the old ways in which they try and solve these problems? And I know you're seeing a lot of this. It would be great to hear your views and examples.
Absolutely. Great question. Anyone want to chime in?
You probably have the best perspective.
Well, I had some ideas, but I don't want to kind of share them yet, but because I wanted to keep them for the conclusion. But the way it's happening is because my fascination is the universities. They are changing. So right here, you know that at Santa Clara University, there is something called Frugal Innovation Lab, where they are training next-generation American engineers to think frugally, as you say, a new mindset. At Stanford, there's a program called the Entrepreneurial Design for Extreme Affordability, co-led by James Patel, who spoke here a few months ago. Again, that's where this product Embrace came from. So, and then finally, exciting news this year, at MIT, so Mark talked about it, there's something called the Tata MIT Center for Frugal Engineering, which is going to be launched this year, funded by the Indian company Tata Group. So I actually think that universities in this country are beginning to train next generation engineers and business leaders who can think and act frugally. That's very exciting. It's still a drop in the kind of, you know, ocean. But I think that the more we see programs like this, you know, popping up all over the U.S., we might begin to see, like, you know, a new generation of, you know, young people thinking and acting differently. So thank you.
I would just add, though, that I think it's important to remember that things always change. So, you know, 20 years from now, I think we should reconvene this exact same panel, and I suspect we'll be sitting up here saying, that's you got innovation. That's great, but that's got to go. We've got to find the next
absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely.
Right? So I do think
thanks,
there's
Jennifer.
A process. Sorry, Navi, but after
absolutely.
20 years, you will have done
of
very
course.
Well with this book.
I will have another book.
Right, but there's a process of creative destruction, right, that is going on constantly. And so we have to just be careful that as we're thinking about these new ideas, that we're not sort of enshrining them and then creating the hardened structures that we're going to then be beating up on again
absolutely.
In a few years.
And they have to be tethered to a need. That's the best innovation has a purpose. So if you're just creating labs without a purpose, without a connection to a need, you're gonna probably create the world that Jennifer's talking about.
And I think something that I strongly believe is that really in order to innovate, you have to be two things. You have to be inspired and you have to be hungry. And if you're in a large organization, so doctors are fantastic at being inspired and identifying problems in the system, but they're not hungry enough to work until midnight every night to come up with a solution faster than that entrepreneur down the road who saw the same thing. And entrepreneurs, on the other hand, sometimes they work really hard on ideas that weren't inspired by an actual problem, an actual market need. So really, if you can bring these groups together and get kind of cross-disciplinary teams that are both inspired and hungry, then I think we can have the best innovation.
So I'll be a little more provocative.
Absolutely.
Tune in, turn on, drop out. I'm sorry, the educational institutions are not architected to be able to track how rapidly this is changing. You can go into General Assembly and pick up any tools you need right now to be able to learn how to program software, mobile, gaming apps. You can come into Tech Shop right now and inside of 30 to 90 days learn what you need in order to be able to innovate. It is a completely different new world. It is radically different. So if you don't have the guts to do that, then get through school as fast as you can because the world is changing.
Yeah. It's also about learning by doing. You're talking about a different way of learning. The lady was waiting for a while.
My name is Anita Chung. I volunteer with San Francisco Plus Acumen, and last night we held a salon dinner that sold out, and it was really an eye-opening moment. The topic was how technology transforms lives at the base of the pyramid. And it was amazing to see people from different areas, from traditional energy sector, Chevron, to renewable energy startup, to charitable giving, to nonprofit helping out refugees, to come together, really understand and what are the needs at the base of the pyramid. And what they came away with, the aha moments, were that they really want to get an understanding of what are the successes and failures of some of these innovations. And I feel that there's a growing need of people from very different disciplines, all age groups, to understand this sector a little bit more and to contribute in some way, even to impart wisdom within their companies that they work at currently. So I was wondering how have you responded to communities or people that are, you know, reached out to you to find out ways how they can contribute in a larger way?
Anyone want to? I think Jennifer, you talked about also, I think one of the things I remember that some of the people you're working with are community banks, right? Not just large banks, isn't it?
That's true. But what your question made me think of, or your description of the event made me think of something else. Mm-hmm. For much of this discussion, we've sort of made these broad assumptions about technology access, technology usage, comfort with technology. And we're big believers in it ourselves. I can tell you that the number one question we get, whether we're talking to sort of nonprofits providing social services on the ground, or even to financial institutions, is they doubt that sort of bottom of the pyramid consumers either have access to or would prefer to use technology channels for conducting financial services. There's this sort of baked-in assumption that everyone wants or needs their hand to be held, or they want some kind of in-person interaction. And I think that that's generally not true. All of the research sort of bears that out. But nonetheless, I do think it's important to think about where technology is a helper. And where it really is creating unnecessary obstacle or barrier, you know, human touch does still matter. And I think we don't tend to think about that enough. And I think that's an important element that I thought about in your description.
Great. Thank you so much. We have time for one last question, then to wrap up. Please.
I'm John Eckhouse. I have actually a specific question for Beth, I think. For a very large company that's working overseas with frugal innovation, what works best, to have the people there who are used to working frugally and know the culture, or to bring some people over who maybe see this with different eyes, even though they're not used to working frugally and don't know the culture? Is there one that works better?
That's such a great question, and the answer is both.
Mm-hmm. I figured you were going to say that.
It's fraught, but I will say it's fraught with a lot of tension. Mm. It's you want things that can translate globally, but be applied locally. You want a need local that can then, you know, reverse innovation is something our version of this we've championed. I actually don't like the phrase because it sounds like it's backwards. It's as it should be. You want something that starts here and can go other places. It is, companies have to force it. That's what we had to do. We had to force it to say, we're going to, I'll give you an example. The woman who's leading GE Healthcare in India grew up in the U.S., educated, has most of her career has been spent in developed markets. She's now running India for us as an American with a team that's made up of very global engineers, people from France, people from India, people from China. And it's fraught with tension, but it's a healthy tension. And what's most important is that they have to live and breathe with the customers that have the problem. So I would say you have to have that first. But the ideal is to create that tension and then force. So Terry, who's in India, she's not going to stay in India the rest of her career. The whole idea is to then put her somewhere else at some point where she can go and kind of take those learnings and over time change our healthcare business.
Absolutely. Another company that is doing that is Carlos Ghosn's Renault-Nissan. So what happened is that last summer, he dispatched the number two guy in his company named Girard de Turbe, who was the head of product development, to go live in a humid tropical climate of Chennai in southern India. And from Chennai, they are going to be developing all the next generation ultra-low-cost cars, not only for emerging markets, but also for Eastern Europe and potentially Western Europe as well. So Beth's point is very important, is that you need to essentially take these senior leaders and put them in the places where they can empathize with the needs of the local consumers, and then also cultivate this kind of frugal, flexible mindset so that when they come back to headquarters, I call that they will inject this virus in the mothership, which I think is very important. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we have to wrap up. So I want to first of all thank the panelists for a fantastic job they did. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I just want to say that this is something that is happening not only in the corporate world and entrepreneurial world we heard today, but it's also happening in the government sector. And 2 weeks ago, I was at the White House on invitation by the FEMA. So what's happening is that the White House also is promoting frugal innovation. They have something called the White House Office of Social Innovation and Civic Participation, which actually celebrates and encourages grassroots innovation that is very frugal and inclusive. And then the FEMA also is now beginning to embrace frugal innovation. So when I was there 2 weeks ago, it was fascinating to see how they're involving people like the hackers and third-party developers to actually intervene after crises like Hurricane Sandy. So the point I'm making is that frugal innovation is really a movement that is actually emerging across the U.S., which is facilitated and enabled by not only large companies and entrepreneurs, but even the government as well. So with that note, I want to thank you, and I would like to invite Kevin to formally close this discussion.
Okay, thank you, Navi. I'd just like to let our audience listening at home know that today our program is How Frugal Innovation is Reviving the U.S. Economy, led by Navi Raju. Today our other panelists have been Beth Comstock, Hallie Tecco, Jennifer Tesher, and Mark Hatch. So thank you to our audience here at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you to our audience listening at home. And with this, I will close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion.